There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out, is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rippin'.
Member Guest Podcast, episode number, 30-something, I think, that we're on, which is actually quite impressive that we've made it this far. Today's guest is one of Windsong's finest, one of our great friends, Mr. Rick Helling, a.k.a. Beef. Beef, welcome to my garage and welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be back.
Oh, yeah. Second time on the podcast. I wasn't here the first time.
Appearance. Yeah, it was Band and Dunes recap.
Oh, yeah. Our number one episode that's been viewed every time I look at the analytics. It's always Band and Dunes and on YouTube.
I mean, so that means you're like number one.
Yeah. You know, where else would I be?
The bar is set high. Exactly. It's set high.
Yeah, maybe we need to do some more like course recaps and put that test to theory and see if it's just because Beef and it was Jack, right? Reister.
Yep.
Or if it's because people are searching for how to play Band and Dunes. One of the two.
Probably a combo.
So welcome back. I wasn't here last time. We don't have Andy in studio with us today. Tony, Johnny, myself, and Rick Helling. So we'll get into your story a little bit. We love to talk with ex-athletes and I guess current athletes, but people who have really translated, you know, what they've done in their careers, all the accomplishments they've done, which you've had a couple, and how that's translated to golf and life. Hear about stories. I know you've played a lot of awesome courses. So if you just want to give the audience maybe a little background about your career in the MLB, I believe two World Series rings.
Two World Series rings, both with the Florida Marlins.
And when I told you this a couple weeks ago when I was doing research on Beef, prepping for this type of stuff, I saw that he threw a perfect game in AAA.
Correct.
Yep. A lot of accomplishments. So wow. I won't say any more. Why don't you give us the background and then I'll chime in.
Sure. I grew up in North Dakota in a really small town. And was a multi-sport athlete, and whatever the season was my favorite sport. I didn't really choose a sport until I literally was in college. Originally signed to play football at North Dakota, where Tony played football. We're a few years apart. He's younger than me, but we have that in common. Both played linebacker. I did not return kicks like Tony, but that's a strange combo to be a linebacker and return kicks. But hey, Tony could do it.
Just a brick shit house, man.
Yeah.
Were you pretty fast? You can
return kicks.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't put slow people back there. Yeah, that's not.
I ran in the Olympics.
Yeah, my brother-in-law. But anyways, I played all the sports. Thought I was going to be a football player. Thought I would be a professional football player. And kind of a weird thing happened. My American Legion team made the Legion World Series the summer before my freshman year of college, and we went down there and I pitched the first game and threw a complete game and beat Richmond, Virginia, which is definitely more of a hotbed for baseball than Fargo, North Dakota is. So after the game, there was probably 50 scouts came up to me and my coach and kind of they were like, who are you and where are you playing college baseball? And I'm like, well, I'm not. And I'm playing football. And that's kind of when everything started. They're like, yeah, you might want to look into playing baseball. So literally, I was supposed to be at college playing college football. And that's when the light bulb went off for me that, you know what, I might have a future in baseball if I decided to pursue it. So some things happened. A bunch of scouts kept calling me that fall. I got redshirted. I didn't play for the first time in my life. I had to sit and watch. So that sucked. During that fall, like I said, scouts were calling me. One of my best friends was calling me. He went to a JUCO in Illinois. He's like, you should come down here. All of our pitchers are, going D1. These guys all have scholarship offers. You're better than all of them. If you came down here, I bet you'd get a D1 scholarship. So went down there, and a year and a half later, I ended up at Stanford University and played in the Olympics and became a first round draft pick. And next thing you know, I'm playing big league baseball and tricked them for 13 years and made a nice career out of it.
So. Seems like that was probably a good decision.
Yeah. Did you want to play football? Like, was your heart in football? And it just was like, man, I just might be better at baseball and should give it a try. Or what was the, like, how do you decide between those two things when you're clearly an elite athlete at both of them? Like, how do you decide which one?
Yeah, it was 100%. I wanted to play football. I loved football. I still, to this day, football is my favorite sport. I still think I'm better at football than I was at baseball. But back then, you know, I'm old, as we've talked about many times at the golf course.
Tell the audience how old you are.
I am 52.
52.
So, okay. But back then, you know, you either made the NFL or you were done, basically. There was no way to prove yourself. There wasn't no arena league. There wasn't any NFL Europe or any of that stuff. So, you know, I was realistic. I was going to a good Division II school, but a Division II school in North Dakota. And, you know, it's like, how many 6'3", 240-pound middle linebackers are there in the world? There's a lot. And, like, am I going to get seen being in North Dakota? Probably not. I'd have to do something really amazing or have, you know, get a free agent tryout. And, you know, it's possible. But in baseball, you know, you could be drafted back then in the 70th round and you go in to play in minor league baseball. And if you prove yourself from level to level, you can work your way up. You don't have to be a high draft pick to make it. And, you know, there's injury factor. There's all these other things that kind of went into it. And I used the logical side of my brain and that won out over my heart. My heart was football for sure. Like, I loved football and I miss it to this day. People that know me well would tell you, you know, I don't play golf on Sundays. I sit and watch football. Like, I'm an avid fantasy football guy. Like, I follow college football. I'm still very close with the University of North Dakota football coaches and program. But, you know, like I said, my analytical side and, you know, that side told me, like, you might want to try baseball. And the cool thing was, when I left North Dakota at Christmas break, I left my full ride scholarship. I think I was scout player of the week 11 times out of like 14 weeks. So, like, I had a very good fall. I went in to tell the coaches I was leaving to pursue baseball, and they told me, we wish you the best of luck. If it doesn't work out, you can come back. Your scholarship will always be here. So I thought that was really cool. We've talked about it since. They thought I was crazy. They thought I was going to be an All-American or All-Conference linebacker and would have had an awesome career there. And they were kind of like, well, we told you could come back because we thought you'd honestly come back, you know? So, but now we look back on it and joke or whatever. But I thought that was super cool that, you know, they lost one of their top recruits and full ride guy that left, and they weren't like pissed. Like, I can't believe you did this. This is bullshit. Now you screwed our program. They're like, yeah, good luck. And if it doesn't work out, you can come back. So it was pretty cool.
It is awesome. So then, so Stanford, and then how is the, cause I know the MLB draft, I mean, your first round picks are probably a little bit different, but like you said, it goes really deep. A lot of players, everybody always sees, you know, guys like, Russell Wilson, Kyler Murray, all these like guys that still get drafted and then go play other sports, but they're still getting drafted in baseball. What's it like getting drafted as a first round pick? And then, like, what are the expectations from there? Like, did you expect to be a first round pick? Cause it sounded like it happened really quick. The transition happened really quick.
Yeah, it really did. Like, I was very naive. Like, I knew I was a good player for a kid from North Dakota. Like, I was better than most players in North Dakota. I was bigger and stronger than most kids in North Dakota. But in all honesty, I thought on a scale of 1 to 10, I thought I was maybe a 2 compared to a kid from Texas or Florida or California. Like, I held those states and those, you know, those places with bigger populations, more people playing, in such high regard that I was like, I can't compete. Like, they have to be so much better than me. That's kind of what I thought. And, you know, so I came out of nowhere, literally. Like, when I started getting recruited out of my JUCO, my JUCO coach didn't know who I was, first of all. He found out, you know, and then coaches from around,
this guy?
Right, literally, like, this kid from the cornfields in North Dakota just fell in my lap, 6'3", 220-pound pitcher that can throw and throw strikes. And they started calling him about other kids in the Midwest because he was really known as a great talent evaluator. So they would ask about high school kids or JUCO kids from the area. And he's like, yeah, I got a guy pitching for me that might have a chance. And they're like, who is it? And they're like, well, he's this kid from North Dakota that nobody knows about. So, like, I literally went from knowing who I was to 2.5 years later, I was a first round draft pick and pitching the Olympics. So, I mean, it's like, it was crazy. And even when I got to Stanford, when I first got there, I wasn't considered like one of our starters. Like, I pitched in relief early. And I kind of earned my way into it. I pitched on Sundays, which is the number 3 starter. So your best starter goes on Fridays, Saturdays are number 2 and 3 starter. I pitched on Sunday for a week or two, pitched well, moved up to Saturdays. And by a month and a half into the season, I was the Friday starter, pitching against every other team's best starter. And we had the best player in the country was our center fielder, Jeffrey Hammond. So granted, there'd be scouts there regardless, but we had like 50 to 100 scouts at every game. you know, they'd be going to watch all of our players, but mainly Jeffrey. Like, he was the guy in the entire country. So, you know, clearly they're going to notice other guys, and all of a sudden they're like, who's this dude pitching? Like, this guy's doing all right. He's getting people out. He's throwing, you know, he's got a nice breaking ball, whatever. And I went from, even at the beginning of the year, I went from no one knew who I was pitching relief, and by the end of the year, I was first round draft pick. So
that's incredible. Decent. I mean, what an arc. And I'm curious to know, just like kind of based off, you were talking a little bit about, like, you had some doubt about competing at that level with some of the other guys. Was there a specific moment or a period of time when that shifted, when you realized, okay, I can really do this? Was there anything that comes to mind right away, or was it more just over time, gradually it started to come easily to you?
Yeah, it was more over time. Again, I was pretty dominant for North Dakota, and then I got to the JUCO in Illinois. Again, that's Midwest, and it's a junior college, so you're not facing elite players, but you're facing, you know, you have to be a good player to play college, whatever it is, for whether sure. It's a JUCO or D3 or D2, whatever. You have to be really good. So I got there, and I pitched very well there, and I'm kind of like, well, this guy's getting a full ride to go to Alabama. That guy's going to Mississippi on a ride. Like, I'm just as good as these guys. So it's like, okay, now I belong here, yep. Right? But that still wasn't like elite D1 like Stanford and USC and Florida State and those schools. And then when I started getting recruited by some of those schools, I'm like, oh, wow. So they actually think I could handle like this big time deal. And I got invited to the Team USA tryouts after my sophomore year. Yeah, that's right. After my sophomore year of JUCO, I was the only JUCO guy invited. And I think partly because I was going, you know, and I had already committed to Stanford at the time, and our head coach at Stanford was very involved in Team USA. And I think he helped me get invited. And I went there again thinking like, well, it's cool I got invited, but there's no way I'm making this team. Like, these are the best players in the country at the biggest blue bread schools. And I did well enough to make the team. So I was on Team USA in 91, and I pitched well that summer. And then again, 92 was the Olympic team. I got obviously invited back for that. And I was kind of our, you know, I don't know if I was our number one starter, but I was one of our best starters. And every time we would play Cuba, which was not every time, but a lot of the times we would play Cuba in a game that meant something, I pitched the game for a couple of reasons. One, I had success and was throwing the ball well, but the other is that team was very right-handed dominant. Mm-hmm. And I was the only kind of right hand. All of our other starters were lefties. So I threw a lot against Cuba, which kind of gave me, you know, an early glimpse into like what big time baseball is on a big time stage. Like, I'm literally facing the best amateur team ever composed in history. And 3 years ago, I was in a town of 1,000 people in the middle of North Dakota. Like, it was crazy how fast it happened.
No kidding. Wow.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, through the recruiting process from JUCO to Stanford, where did you take visits to? Was there other schools that you were evaluating, or was it like Stanford called and you're like, I'm going there?
Yeah. Stanford called late, and they called asking about a high school pitcher in the area. Like, again, up to that point, from what I'd been told, Stanford had never had a junior college baseball player ever transfer in.
Doesn't seem like the type of school that takes a lot of guys.
Yeah. In general, you know, a lot of the guys that go to JUCO either don't have the grades or didn't have the test scores to get into a big time school, or they don't want to go to a big time school and they just go to a JUCO for a year and then sign or whatever it may be. So they were never really interested, but they called my coach. And again, my coach was like, yeah, that high school pitcher from Iowa is pretty good, but I got a guy pitching for me that's better. And once they started looking into me, they're like, this guy is actually not bad. And, they asked my coach again, and he's like, yeah, he's got good grades. He had a good ACT. He's got a perfect, you know, 4.0 GPA in college. And so anyways, that's kind of, but they were late. Up to that point, I'd been contacted by a bunch of schools. I took a visit to North Carolina State. I took a visit to Ole Miss. I took a visit to Bradley University, which was my first big time visit. Like, it was right there in Illinois, and they were kind of one of the first ones to throw interest. And I was, at that time, I'm like, this is sick, man. Like, I'm going on a visit to a D1 baseball school, even though it's not Stanford or USC or Florida State. But to me, that was really cool.
I mean, a year earlier, you're going through 2 days at a football,
football camp. Yeah. University of North Dakota, D2 football. Yeah. So yeah, it was really cool. I really liked Mrs. Ole Miss. I probably, if Stanford wouldn't have come along, I probably would have went to Ole Miss. The school was awesome. They had a new coach. They had pretty new stadium. They were kind of just getting their program, trying to take it to the next level. And I had fun going on my visits. It was pretty cool.
I mean, if you have an opportunity to go to a school like Stanford, you're going to Stanford. I mean,
that's the way I looked at it. I mean, once they showed interest and, you know, again, this is how naive I was. You know, they were like, yeah, we're interested. We'd really like you to have you come. And they're like, you know, we don't know if you can get in. And I'm like, What do you mean?
Grades or?
Yeah. Well, cause it's a crazy hard to get into at that time. I didn't know. I knew it was hard to get into. I knew it was a good school, but
I thought athletic scholarships were like,
not for schools like that.
Stanford, literally, I mean, everybody says, oh, our school doesn't band and we don't make exceptions for athletes. Stanford literally doesn't make exceptions for anyone. Like you have to be like above on board or above what the standards are. You're not getting in there. So again, I was very naive. I had no idea because I'm like, wait a second. I had a 32 on my ACT. That's pretty good. I have 4.0. You know, that's pretty good. Where I grew up, there was no AP, no none of that. So I had no ability to take any courses that were college credit. So I'm like, and they're like, would you mind retaking the ACT? See, and I'm like, okay, to try to get something better than a 32. Like at the time, 34 was a perfect score, I think. So I was,
yeah, you know, 32 solid.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's really good.
Yeah. So I was like sniffing the 30s, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, yeah, I guess I'll retake it. So I retook it, whatever that must have been, fall of my sophomore year at the JUCO, and got 1 point better. I got a 33. So I don't know if that point got me in or what, but. Once they're, you know, I got accepted, they're like, yeah, we'd love to have you come. And I'm like, just like Tony said, it was a no brainer. Like, again, I was realistic. I'm like, well, it'd be great if I play baseball and make a career of it. But if not, I have Stanford education to fall back on. So
Stanford, first round draft pick. And then you go to the MLB. Who drafted you?
Texas Rangers
drafted you. And then you said you won two rings with, the Marlins. And if I remember right, that's Miggy's. The Miggy teams?
That was the 03 team. So that's when Miggy was a rookie, was in 03. 97 was like Kevin Brown and Alex Fernandez, Bobby Bonilla, like guys like that, Gary Sheffield.
And you were back at Florida two different times. So you had went somewhere in between there. It wasn't like you stayed for the Marlins for those 6 years.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it was actually a lot of my buddies joke with me because I was literally in Florida for about one calendar year total. 97, I was there most of the year. I'd gotten traded over at the end of 96 from Texas to Florida, made maybe five starts at the end of that year and pitched very well. And then 97, I was with the team all the way up until August, basically. And I got traded right back to Texas. And then, you know, the team obviously ended up winning the World Series, but I wasn't there. I was back in Texas. But I still got, you know, I got a ring. I think I threw 135 or 40 innings or something for this. So I, you know, I was a
Yeah, you're a contributor fairly, for yeah, sure, big yeah, time.
Contributed, but I wasn't there for the actual World Series. And then in 2003, it was kind of the opposite. So I was in Baltimore that entire year. We didn't have a very good team. And by the time August rolled around, you know, the team, I was a veteran. I'd pitched for a long time. So Baltimore was looking to let some younger guys throw some innings. And they're like, we don't need you to pitch anymore. We want these, see what these young guys can do. So they released me actually, which was fine because they did it actually to help me. They're like, we're not going to try to trade you. We're just going to release you. And then any team, you can sign with anybody you want. So I wasn't happy. Nobody wants to get released. Cause it's like you get released. It's kind of like, well, apparently they don't think I'm good enough, but they handled it the right way. Anyways, once that happened, I had maybe six or eight teams calling, like, we'd love to have you come in. And some teams were like, we'd love to have you start for us. You know, we're in a playoff chase. Some teams were like, maybe in the relief, but kind of do a little bit of both. And at that point, I had literally started my whole career. I did a little bit of relief at the beginning and a very little bit at the end. But so when I was trying to decide, Florida was one of the teams, but they were probably last on my list. Like they had a chance for the wild card, but they were kind of down. You know, there's a lot of good, like established teams like the Cardinals and all these other teams that are like, they're making the playoffs for sure that wanted me. My catcher from Texas all those years was Pudge Rodriguez, and he was catching for the Marlins. He called me personally, and he's like, we got to have you. Like, we don't have any veteran guys. Like, all our whole team's young. He's like, we got a lot of talent, but, you know, these guys don't know how to pitch. And he's like, we need you to come in and, like, help these guys. You know, and he's like, you can stay with me in my house. He's like, I got a guest. You know, he's like, he goes, I have a chef. He can cook for you every day. Like, he's literally like, yeah, so he's giving me the hard sell. Yeah, he's giving me the hard sell. And, you know, everybody likes being wanted, right? Mm-hmm. So I remember talking to my wife and we were trying to figure out where I was going to go. And she's like, you got to go to Florida. Like, they really want you. Like, they're making it sound like if you don't come, it's a big deal. And so I followed my heart, went there, and obviously things happened and we ended up winning the World Series again and we had an awesome time. And so it turned out great.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, what's that like, man? When in the World Series and being on the field when that happens, probably impossible to explain, but like that's peak sports.
Yeah. That's what you work your whole entire life for. Like I'm, I've been a team guy my whole life. Like, that's just who I am. I've never been somebody who cared about me as an individual, or I shouldn't say that. When I was younger, I was pretty cocky, pretty arrogant or whatever. And a lot of it was like, yeah, I just scored 40 points in that basketball game, you know, whatever. But like, as I matured and got older, I realized the important thing is being a good teammate, winning games as a team, you know, hopefully a state title as a high school player, whatever, national title as a college player. So, that's what you literally work your entire life for, is a chance as a baseball player to be in the World Series and then to win the entire thing. So, looking back, man, it's just incredible. There's been so many great players that have never even made it to a World Series ever, let alone win one or two. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that I happened to be in the right place at the right time on some good teams, you know. And as far as what it was like, I'll never forget it. We were in Yankee Stadium. We shut them out, but by we, I mean Josh Beckett, who was absolutely unhittable. And, you know, back then in 2003, he was, you know, one of the best pitchers in baseball. You know, he was throwing upper 90s with his fastball, which was unheard of. His changeup was as fast as my fastball. Like, it was stupid. And he had a hammer that was like in the, you know, upper 80s, low 90s. And he literally was unhittable. I think game six, he was the MVP of the World Series. In game six, I think he threw a 2-hit shutout and they might've gotten three balls out of the infield. Like, it was just absolute domination in Yankee Stadium.
Is that Jeter's on that team? Oh, yeah. Like, who's on the Yankees?
All the big guys.
Was A-Rod still on that team?
No, not in 2002, not in 2003. Sorry. I don't think he was there. You think he was still in Texas, but anyways, it was amazing because the place was just dead silent. And it was like, there was nothing you could just tell. They had no chance. Nothing, like, you could just tell. I mean, the crowd was dead silent. The Yankee hitters, you could tell, like, we are overmatched. Like, it was pretty cool to run in and dogpile, and got some pretty cool pictures out of it. One in my house where I've got the manager up on my shoulder and people are all around. So it's pretty sweet. Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. And I know we've talked on the course before. So, wasn't playing baseball kind of how you got introduced to golf? Because as a pitcher, you're pitching once every, you know, 5-ish days or whatever that might be. And then the off days, guys are bullpen and guys are playing golf. So is that kind of how it began? Because obviously you're a massive golfer now and love the competition. That's kind of what gets the juices flowing, I imagine. Like, how, you know, how'd the love for golf and sports and competition, all that kind of merge together? And then post-career, seems like that's all you do. And maybe not all you do, but it's a lot of what you do. And you've played a lot of awesome courses. Like, how is that, how's that translated, and how do you get into it, and what do you love about it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I didn't, where I grew up was a tiny town in North Dakota. Golf was not a thing back then. We had a 9-hole sand greens golf course, like out by our airport. Like, I think I might have played once or twice as a kid. I obviously had no idea what I was doing. Didn't really play in high school at all. Got to college, didn't play at all at the JUCO, obviously. Got to Stanford, and we had an amazing golf course there. You could play it for, like, I think back then it was literally $5. As a student, you could go play golf. And it's really nice track. And, you know, Nota Begay, Casey Martin, all those guys were my age. And I think both of them were also econ majors. So I got to know those guys a little bit. And, you know, athletes tend to hang together. So, like, hey, man, we should play golf, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, I'll play, like, whatever. I'll go try it. And, you know, I was young and strong and pretty athletic, and I could hit the ball really far. No idea where it was going. But these guys were like, dude, you're pretty good, man. And you're like, you sure you've never played? I'm like, nah, I don't. Like, they're like, well, if you played, like, you could probably be good and whatever. So that's when it first started. And once I got into pro baseball, like you said, it's kind of a thing pitchers tend to do. You know, there's a lot of work that goes in between your starts, the 4 days leading up to your next start. But for me, I was never a partier. I didn't go out at night super late. I wasn't out at bars chasing girls. That wasn't my thing. I like to be active, and I liked the competitiveness of golf. Like, once I realized, like, yeah, I'm a pretty good athlete, but, like, why is it so hard to make this ball go straight? You know, why is it so hard? This ball is not moving. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how am I shooting 97? Like, it says par is 4 shots and I just had 7 shots. Like, how's that? So I got more and more competitive at it, and I try to get, you know, better and better. And I started playing more and more, and, yeah, it just became kind of my thing, and it worked out perfect. It's one of the best perks. And, you know, the guys that are famous for it are like Glavin, Smoltz, you know, Maddox, the Braves guys back in the day. Like, literally all 5 guys on their team our pitchers, they all played. So whoever was pitching that night was the guy that didn't play in the foursome that morning, but they just literally, they would play every day on the road. And, you know, they got to, they were playing all the best tracks. You know, you fly to all these great cities and you get to go play a place where a US Open was, or a PGA Championship or a Ryder Cup or whatever. And you kind of realize, like, this is a pretty nice perk, man. Like, you call up the pro, or you get to know somebody, or you get to know a member, and they're like, yeah, I'll bring you out to San Francisco Golf Club, or yeah, I'll bring you out to East Lake or whatever. And it's like Oakmont. And like, you get to play all these really cool tracks because you're an athlete. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of a nice perk to have. You can, you know, you give them tickets to games, or you do whatever, and you build relationships, and you're playing, you're traveling to all the best cities in the country. So mm-hmm. you get a chance to see different parts of the world. And, it's just a great way to get to meet people. And, you know, there's people that I met 25 years ago when I was playing that I'm still in contact with today, because, and we met through golf. So,
so on the topic of, all the courses that you got to play, what are, well, some of your top courses, your favorites, and then, I would love to hear your thoughts on, cause you've played Augusta, right? Would love to hear your thoughts on Augusta, because anybody that's played there, I always like to pick their brain. And it's actually kind of funny. I got the email today from Augusta. One of the ways to play, if you're not a professional athlete like myself or ex-professional athlete, you can sign up to like work at Augusta and you get to play. Got the email today to put in my application to work.
Wow.
Is that so, like, we'll see. Work the Masters or like?
Yeah, you have to work at the Masters. So you have to be available the entire week, Monday through Sunday, and you work every single day. But then one of the perks is that you get the opportunity to play the following week.
I mean,
so I don't know if I'm going to do it, but like, I think I would literally like be working concessions or like.
Dude, that sounds worth it to me.
Kidding. I think they'd be oversubscribed. You think they'd have like enough people on the list to work until like 2075.
No kidding. No kidding.
You would think. Oh, you have to clean up the porta potty. No problem.
Exactly.
I'm your guy.
Yep.
So
can I use gloves at least? No. Okay, that's still fine. Okay. You got a faucet and some soap. That's all I need.
So I'll keep you posted on that. But for guys like you that have been able to play it, what's it like? And then kind of what are your top courses that you played?
Yeah, I've been fortunate. I've met a lot of people throughout the years, and I played some really cool golf courses. You know, I would say I don't want to rank these courses because I think it's unfair that, you know, they're all amazing. I'd say my top five that I've played personally in the US are, Augusta, Oakmont, Sand Hills, Pine Valley, and Cypress Point. Those would be the top five for me if I, you know, and
it'd probably be everybody's top five.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to go down the list, cause I've been, like I said, I've been very fortunate. I played some really cool courses that people that aren't as famous or they're not ranked as high or whatever, that are just, were amazing experiences. To answer your question about Augusta, I'll give you a quick story of how I got on Augusta.
That'd be awesome.
I think obviously a lot of our friends know this story, but the listeners obviously don't, some will, but so again, these are the kinds of things that can happen. I'm sure it can happen in everyday life too, but especially in golf, like just randomly things happen. So I was in Southern California working in my current job with the Players Association. And I had had some friends that were members at Riviera. So we went out to play Riviera in the morning. And then I was going to the ballpark that afternoon to see, I think it was Dodgers and somebody else. I think it was, anyways. So as I'm leaving the golf course, we played around in the morning, and as I'm walking out of the golf course to the parking lot to get in my rental car with my clubs, I see a car driving in to the bag drop, and the car drives in. It was either a 7 Series BMW or a Mercedes S. I can't remember, S-Class. But the license plate literally said Fargo on it, F-A-R-G-O, like where I'm from. And around the license, California license plate, and the license plate holder, the vanity holder, says Stanford University alumni on it. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. There's no way. So this guy parks his car, or he gets out of his car, starts walking up to the pro shop or into the club or whatever. And I'm walking, I'm like, I gotta say something. I mean, I have to. So I'm like, excuse me. I'm like, I noticed your license plate. I'm like, are you from Fargo? And the guy's like, yeah, I am. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, I'm from Fargo. He's like, oh, that's cool. He's like, what a coincidence. And I'm like, did you go to Stanford University? He's like, yeah, I did. He goes, you went to Stanford? I said, yeah, I did. And he goes, you're Rick Helling, aren't you? That's literally what he said. right then.
Two sentences.
Yeah.
Fargo. And I was like, Fargo.
Sure am. Fargo? Fargo? Stanford.
Stanford University. And he goes, you're Rick Helling, aren't you? I'm like, yeah. I go, how would you know that? He goes, well, there's hasn't been many of us from Fargo that have gone to Stanford. And he goes, I know your Aunt Clara and I know your Uncle Ken and this and that. And he's literally started going on and on about all these people that he knew and all these connections. And he was much older than me, but just a super nice guy. And we get to talking and he's like, what are you doing in town? And I told him, "What, you know, I'm work for the Players Association now and I'm in town just doing my job and played golf here this morning. He's like, oh, that's great. And we're just kind of chatting. And he's like, what are you doing tomorrow? And I'm like, well, I'm flying out tomorrow later. You know, in the morning, I'm playing Sherwood Country Club. He's like, oh, that's too bad. He's like, I could have taken you out to LA Country Club. He's like, I'm a member there. And I'm like, oh, you don't say.
Give me one moment.
Yeah, I'm like,
you know what?
I'm like, what time are you thinking? He's like, well, anytime you want. I'm like, I can play in the morning. So I call my buddy at Sherwood, and I'm like, I'm not going to make it. And I told him why, and he's like, dude, I don't blame you. Like, you got to go play LA. So I went and played the next morning with him at LA. And it was super cool. As we walk around, this guy's like, he's kind of one of the guys at LA. Like, he was, you know, he had Fargo on his license plate. He had Fargo stitched on his golf spikes. He was wearing a hat from Fargo Country Club of all places, right? He's a member at LA. And so, and then as we walk around there, but you know, kind of like everybody at the club here calls me Beef. Everybody's like, Fargo, you know, I'm like, oh, well, he's like, yeah, that's what they call me. And this and that. I'm like, so we're talking, had breakfast and we went out to play and we get, again, pretty naive. I mean, I think I'm fairly street smart now, but back then, pretty naive. I didn't realize there was two different logos for Augusta National. There was the member logo and then there was the tournament logo. I just knew the logo. So we're maybe four or five holes in and I noticed he had on the members logo. At the time, I just thought it was the logo. So I said, oh, have you been to the Masters? He's like, oh yeah. He goes, I go pretty often. I'm like, that's awesome. I'm like, how is it? And he's like, it's great. Like, it's an awesome event. And I'm like, really? I said, how does that work or whatever? He's like, well, he goes, I'm a member there. And he's like, we have to work. So he goes, I do different things. Sometimes I'm on as a scorekeeper. Sometimes I'm on the tee box. I'm like, oh, I said, so you're a member at Augusta and LA Country Club. Okay. And I just met you yesterday morning. Interesting. He's like,
knew me before.
Yeah. Yeah. You knew me. You knew me when I said, so would've then
been
he
great
goes,
if you called me before we just randomly met in a parking lot.
Yeah. So then he's like, he goes, I'm also at Cypress Point. I'm like, all right. So you're at three of the five best clubs in the country. That's not bad. That's all right. So
seems to be doing okay.
Yeah. So anyways, we end up having a great day and talking and just getting along awesome. And, you know, half jokingly, half serious at the end, I'm like, if you ever need a fourth for Augusta, just give me 2 hours. Like, that's all I need. I live in Minneapolis. Delta flies there. Like, I'll be there. And he's like, he goes, all right. He's like, I'll let you know. So sure enough, like 3 years later, I get an email from him. I open the email and literally, I'm sure my jaw hit the floor. Like, I was like, holy shit. I just got invited to Augusta. Like,
what did it say? Do you remember?
Well, he's like, he goes, I got a group. He's like, I got two of my buddies here from Southern California. He's like, we need a fourth. He's like, I thought you'd be the perfect guy. He's like, I think you'd like these guys. And I'm like, I called my wife right away. She wasn't in the house. I called her right away. And I'm like, honey, I got invited to Augusta. You know, the dates are, she's like, you're going. I'm like, yeah, I know. I was just calling to tell you. She's like, you have to go. And I'm like, honey, trust me. I'm not asking permission. I'm just calling you to tell you. And so she might've been as excited as I was or more, but, so that's how I got invited to Augusta. So I flew down there and met those guys.
Amazing.
We were there, played three rounds, two from the member tee, one from the championship. We played the par three course. We stayed right there in the villa right off of number 10. It was pretty incredible.
God, isn't that crazy? It just goes to show what can happen if you go and talk to some random person, right? And there was some more uniqueness to that situation because you guys had the ties, but you wouldn't have said anything to him.
Right.
Never would have played Augusta. Well, maybe you might have, but still in that fashion, pretty incredible.
It is incredible. And that's one of the things you asked, like, you know, what about golf is important to me or why I like it so much or why, you know, and that's one of the things. It's the relationships. It's the, you know, those kind of stories. Like, that's just, and again, that could happen in a random, you could be walking down the street and see somebody with a Fargo license plate and whatever, but it's just like all pretty much, you know, most of the people here in Minnesota, since we moved here, a lot of them I've met through golf and my best friends, you know, we have our friends from our neighborhood and that our kids went to school with. We have that group of friends, some of which are also golfers, but all my other friends are literally people that I've met through golf. And it's like, my wife and I have formed great relationships with all these people. And it's golf that brought us together. You know, it's like randomly getting paired up on the golf course. Like, hey, this guy, Tony, he played football in North Dakota. You know, like, I think you guys would get along. That's how Tony and I met. Like, so like Climbrook paired us up one day, and like, now here we are, however many years later, we're good buddies. Our wives are good friends. They play golf together. They draw really
what
cool
was it like
pictures
seeing
on their scorecards.
What was it like seeing Tony drive the ball for the first time?
Dude,
it's hard to explain to people, because I've actually had people ask me like, dude, does Tony really hit the ball 350? I'm like, and it looks like he's hitting a pitching wedge.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, there's no way. Like, you're simulating. I'm like, it's not on the simulator, man. Like, he does it in real life. It's not like a glitch.
It's crazy. I mean, I've been telling people forever, and I honestly believe this. I played with a lot of good players. I played with a lot of tour pros. I played with a lot of dudes that bomb it. We all have. Like, we've all been around and have played with really impressive golfers. I know Tony's very humble. I honestly believe this man sitting across from us is the longest player on the planet that does not get paid to hit a golf ball. Like, whether it's, you know, mini tour or like trying to be a long drive guy or even a professional or a teaching professional that happens to have crazy speed or whatever it may be, for golf to be his hobby, granted, he's very good at it and it's a big time hobby, he works really hard, to just have that natural speed, and like, he clearly works on it too, but I know Tony's not trying to get faster. He's trying to get straighter. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's been blessed with incredible club head speed. And you're right. It looks like he's hitting a 60-yard pitch shot to a tight pin. That's how he swings, and the ball just comes off his club and it launches. Unless you see it in person, it's hard to believe how far the ball goes with the swing that he has. And what I love is playing with people that have never played with Tony before for the first time. Cause again, the way he swings, it's like, oh, that's a nice swing. And then you go out to your balls and it's like, here's our three balls. And there's Tony 70 yards ahead of us. And the guys will look at me and like, what the fuck? And I'm like, yeah, dude.
Oh man, that
like,
must've hit the down slow.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No, that's not far. He hits it. Did he just hit a 3-wood? I'm like, yeah. 3-wood goes 345, 360. Like, that's his 3-wood. It's like,
confirmed.
Stupid.
Can confirm. Yep.
Yeah, it's actually insane. And kind of, you know, one of the other things I wanted to talk to about beef, and like, we have a lot of people, you know, that listen that are club golfers and, you know, maybe play competitively or starting to get into a little bit more competition golf. I know that you do a lot of events. You know, there's a lot of cool stuff that we do at Winsong. Like, what goes into that, you know, team aspect, where I know like you and Tony are captain, assistant captains of like the Mac Cup stuff that we do at Winsong. You've done a lot of those things. Like, what is that like being the kind of the leader and bringing that team aspect together, whether it's at the club or with your buddies? What goes into that, and how do you, I imagine one, you love doing it because it's the competition aspect, but maybe talk a little bit about how you, whether it's choose players or teams or kind of get those events going together, just because with where golf has been going, I mean, a lot of people now are starting to do, whether it's at clubs or through public courses, like get games and teams, and kind of it's starting to become more and more common. And so I think people might appreciate or really like the, you know, the thought process into what goes into that.
Yeah. Again, I'm a big team guy and always have been. The camaraderie and the fellowship that we have at Winsong, I think, is unique. I know there's a lot of great courses, and I would never say, you know, we're this and they're below us or any of that, but I just think what we have is unique. That's, you know, that's, I think, the easiest way to say it. We have so many guys that just have kind of common interests and, like, love the game and just love Winsong. Like, my wife will say Winsong is your happy place. Like, when you go to Winsong, you're happy. And that's, I think, across the board, that's for all of us. And I know everybody's like, well, I'm happy when I go to my club. I'm happy. I know we all are. It's just unique at Winsong because we probably have 100 guys that you could just randomly throw their names in a hat and pick out, you know, 25 foursomes, and everybody would get along and they'd have an awesome time. Mm-hmm. So, or more. I mean, I'm just throwing a number 100 out there. But so there's a lot of things that we've done over the years just to kind of encourage that and make that even stronger. And those team events, like you're talking about, is part of it. You know, we have the Friday game, which I think you guys have mentioned here and there on the podcast, where I kind of got thrown into handling that a few years ago. And we've grown that from, I think at the time it was maybe 12 to 20 guys that were playing on Fridays that could play. And now it's up to 75, 80 guys that are on the list. And it's like, again, I want as many guys that want to be a part of it as possible. And I intentionally, when I put the groups together, I intentionally try to make sure guys are playing with people that they don't usually play with. Like, that's the whole idea. Mm-hmm. Like, we all play with our buddies. We all love going out on a whatever Wednesday afternoon, like, hey, let's go play banker or play, you know, have a good game. But on Friday, I want guys like, you know what? I don't know if I've ever played with that guy before. Like, I don't ever remember Tony playing with, you know, Sammy or whatever it may be. And I'll put those guys together and I'll try to put the teams together so everybody gets to know each other a little bit better. And that's become really popular. And I think the big reason why is because it's gotten guys to get out of their little, you know, their little group that they're really comfortable with and branch out. And then next thing you know what? Now I've got a new group, or now I've got 4, 6, 8, 10 other guys that I love playing with. And that fosters that, you know, the Mac Cup and the rodeo and these other things that you mentioned. Those are just other things to get guys having a good time and get the wives involved too. That's the other cool thing about both of those events, because, you know, we're out there playing, the guys are out there playing, but the wives and the girlfriends are behind the scenes. Like, as a part of the event, they can come out afterwards and have dinner and cocktails, and they get to socialize. And, you know, it's not just the guys having a great time. We're on the course having an awesome time, but the ladies get to know each other, and then they build friendships, and then they're playing in the derby or whatever, all these other events, as you know, and maybe not making a real score, but drawing cute little martini glasses on the scorecard or whatever. But, and I just think it's really important to foster that and to get, you know, to get that out there. And, you know, the rodeo and the Mac Cup, like you said, are both very competitive events, and people want to win those, and those teams are hard to get on. But they're fun. And like, the guys that are trying to be on those events, they're taking it very seriously, and for me, when I was first getting involved in the Mac Cup, it was something that it was literally the highlight of my summer. Like, I was working my ass off to make sure I earned my spot on that team. It goes back to the competitive thing. Like, me as a competitor, like, that's my thing now. Like, I'm not pitching anymore. I'm not playing baseball anymore. I want to be a good enough golfer. I want to be a good enough guy off the course that the captain is going to choose me because he thinks I'm the right guy for the team. And that gives me something to drive for. And I think that's kind of my goal going forward with both the rodeo and the McKenzie Cup, is to have that feeling. I want guys to be like, I want to be on this fucking team, man. Like, I want to be on Team Winsong. That's kind of, and I think that fosters those relationships.
I also think, you know, the guys that play in the types of events, there's 100 guys, like you talked about, that would love to be a part of all these events, and it is hard to make the teams. But I also think it's you know, it is a compliment to you, as the way that people view you. You are the captain of you know, the Stallions of the rodeo. You're also the captain of the team at Winsong for the McKenzie Cup, but you're also like the commissioner of like 4 fantasy football leagues, and you do all these things because everybody trusts you and knows that you're going to do everything the right way. And so I think that goes a long ways, because you're on the Friday game. Everybody looks up to you. Everybody's looking to be included and wants to have a good time. And that's just a compliment to you in the way that you just live your life in general. So,
and I roped him into another fantasy league this year. Dynasty league.
And I'm pretty sure he's the commissioner. One of the commissioners.
Co-commissioner.
Yeah, co-commissioner. I definitely need help. I need help drafting.
As co-commissioner, as well. I may not have approved a couple of your trades.
No, I'm joking. No chance.
When you're 3 minutes after the draft is end, he's like, I got to rebuild.
I'll be back in 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Good man. Last thing I would love. So we're going to have, hopefully, knock on wood, Fout come on here this fall. You've been across the street. A lot of people that listen obviously know about Winsong and have heard about the new course and get questions a lot about it. Would love your take on the new course. I think you've gone over and done one of the tours and stuff. What do you think it's going to be like? Because I hear you talk about it all the time and say, like, this course is going to be awesome. It's going to be like a championship level course. Curious on your thoughts on Winsong Farm South?
North.
Yep. North.
I think it's going to be awesome. I think it's going to be a perfect complement to what we have right now. The main course, the current course, which will be South, you know, we've all played it a million times. Probably a lot of listeners have played it. We have a lot of tight chipping areas around the greens. If you miss a green, the ball tends to roll off down to a chipping area. One of the things across the street, it's going to be more balls are going to be able to roll onto greens. Like you're going to be able to use the contours to make a ball. It's kind of the opposite feeling. Again, if you miss in the wrong spot, it's going to be tough to get up and down. But it's to me, it's kind of cool that we have the opposite concept. Like current course, you miss the green. If it goes a little long, a little left or whatever, it's going to go roll off a false side or a false front. New course, you can intentionally try to hit it short to bounce it on the green or intentionally hit it right to bounce it off that slope to get it on the green. So I think it's a really cool contrast into style, even though it's the same designer. I love the fact that there's going to be some risk reward out there. I really like the design. I like the 6 par 3s. As you guys all know, we have the 20 club out there and the 20 club can get dangerous.
Well, with six you know what else? You know what else will get dangerous with 6 par 3s?
Banker? Yeah.
Banker could be very will dangerous. Get real dangerous.
But it's going to be a real golf course. It's going to be for short yardage wise. And I think I've heard you guys talk about it before. You know, it's 6,600 yards, whatever it is, but you know, I factor in 6 par 3s, you know, you add a couple hundred yards or whatever, 150 yards to each of those. And now you're up to 7,000 yards for a par 72. And that's a championship length golf course. It's going to be a great test and it's going to be awesome to have it. I think I've always been very excited about it. Like, I'm not going to lie. I mean, my thought has always been like, who wouldn't want a second course? Like, why? Like, you know, and there's been, you know, everybody, there's naysayers here like, oh, it can't be as good as the first course. First course is amazing. It's like, why would we have one awesome course and one mediocre? That makes no sense. Like everywhere I've ever been, both courses are really good. Like the upper and the lower are great. The east and the west are great. The north and the south, they're both great. You know, typically one is ranked slightly higher than one the other, but you don't ever see like, you know, Whisper Rock lower ranked 46th in the top 100 and then the uppers ranked 1,005th. Like, you know what I mean? Like yeah. they're both really good golf courses. Same with, you know, Baltusrol or whatever. And I think that's how we're going to be. I think both courses are going to be awesome. I think they're going to be fun to play in their own ways. And it's going to give our members and our guests an opportunity to have two unique venues, similar but unique, which I think is going to be really cool.
And, you know, extremely unique in the fact that there's no other place within a 6-hour drive that has two courses. So, I mean, we have a pretty amazing opportunity that's going to be happening for, you know, anybody that can join and play a round with a member or as a guest or however you'd be playing out at Winsong. But it's going to be a really, really special thing.
Well, Beef, we know you've got a rest up this week, big weekend out at the farm and out at Hazeltine. So, really appreciate you coming on. It's crazy how fast nearly close to an hour goes. So, it definitely won't be the last. We'll have to, do something else maybe next year and have you review another course. Cause apparently those are the ones that blow up for our podcast on, Apple, Spotify, all major platforms and YouTube. So appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. My pleasure, guys. It was
appreciate
awesome.
You.
I do it anytime.
Thanks, Ricky. Thanks, guys.